Hello, this is Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 58, and today I'm joined at the 51st annual meeting of SPEP in Rochester, New York, by Sylvia Benso. She is a professor of philosophy at Rochester Institute of Technology, where she teaches courses in ancient Greek philosophy, contemporary European philosophy, the history of philosophy, ethics, and feminist philosophy. Besides having published articles on Nietzsche, Heidegger, Levinas, and ancient philosophy, especially Plato, she is the author of Thinking After Auschwitz, Philosophical Ethics, and Jewish Theodicy, that's in Italian, The Face of Things, A Different Side of Ethics, and the co-author of the volume Environmental Thinking Between Philosophy and Ecology, that's also in Italian. She is also the general co-editor of the series Contemporary Italian Philosophy, published by SUNY Press. And I would be remiss if I did not also say that she's a graduate of the philosophy PhD program at Penn State.
That's right.
Exactly. So she's a longtime member and friend of the Ancient Philosophy Society. So when we found out that we were coming to Rochester for SPEP, we knew just who we wanted to invite to speak at the APS at SPEP session, which she just did. So she joins me today on the Digital Dialogue to speak about the paper that she just delivered here at SPEP, Life, Death, and Leisure, Recovering Socrates' Love of the World. So welcome, Sylvia, to the Digital Dialogue.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be part of it.
It's great to have you. So we just got out of your session. It was a really great session, I thought, at the APS. And maybe you could talk a little bit about the paper that you gave, just summarize it a little bit for those of us, or those who didn't hear it, and then we'll enter into a general discussion. It was really, I thought, a wonderful account of the Phaedo and of Socrates' last words and that whole dramatic scene.
Right. Yes, I'm taking my move from Socrates' last scene, where he has this very enigmatic, mysterious statement, Crito io e cacto Asclepius, pay it and do not neglect it. And what I am trying to do is basically to liberate Socrates' last moments from the Nietzschean reading, which is so famous among so many people, that these words signify some sort of a dismissal or a condemnation of life, and earthly life, bodily life. And what I tried to do in the paper was to say that, in fact, Socrates is very much concerned with physical life, and he devotes his entire life to this bringing together the mental, the intellectual, the philosophical, and the bodily, corporeal, earthly dimensions of life in his very person. And the very scene at the end of the Phaedo is a signal of that. I looked for great, and I found Socrates was very endearing in his last gesture that he has toward Phaedo, stroking his hair. And so I sort of went through some of the dialogues looking for these moments of attention to the body, which are there all over, I think, in the dialogues. And this last sentence invokes this god Asclepius, who is the god of bodily health. So it would seem weird if Socrates were to make this last invocation. You know, he starts with Apollo when he initiates, he begins his philosophical activity, and Apollo is the god of light and enlightenment and reasoning and so on. But then he dies under the sign of a bodily god, god who is concerned with health. So I go and try to retrieve, you know, this notion of health and physical health.
So, I mean, I thought your account of the final scene and particularly thematizing the notion of uncovering the face. So, I mean, in that scene, as the hemlock is creeping up the body slowly from below, right, beginning with the feet and moving slowly up, and then there's a moment where his head is uncovered and he makes these final words. Talk a little bit maybe about this, the notion of uncovering, of revealing in that sense.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting because here you have a Socrates who is basically dead, right?
Right.
And I find it, as I say, in the tragicity of the moment, I mean, he's dying, is a very heavy moment, but there is this almost comical aspect where all of a sudden he's all there, you can imagine the room, everybody's still, and he uncovers his face. It's
right.
Like a bouncing back of life.
Right.
And so there is this uncovering, which is an uncovering, well, clearly of his face, and that reminds us to other situations, more specifically the Phaedrus, where Socrates also uncovers his face to signal that there is something more going on. There is the uncovering of the face, but in my reading, that uncovering actually reveals the power of physical life. So in the Phaedrus, it's easier to decode. Socrates is concerned with the power of erotic beauty, the power of beauty and how physical beauty can be destructive and attractive to Socrates. The aim of Socrates' discourse, which is the notion of love.
Yeah.
And in this situation, what we get to have uncovered through the uncovering, or what we get to be revealed through the uncovering, is the power over the frailty of bodily life, the frailty of human life, which is always exposed to the power of physical disintegration. And ultimately, so what gets to be revealed is not only the power of life, but it's life itself, because in this uncovering, what is at stake is the relation between life, physical life, and death. Yeah. And death is always, first of all, a physical death.
That very word that ekalupto is the is the Greek word, and that appears, as you mentioned, in the Phaedrus, and it does have a kind of religious overtone to it. This notion and it is bound up with this transitional period. So I wonder, and you gestured to it in your paper, but can we relate this more tightly to the notion of aletheia as revealing, and the context in which the dialogue unfolds? So one of the things I try to argue in, we were talking a little bit about the book that I'm working on on Plato and Socrates, and part of the point I want to make there is that the way in which the dialogue is framed as a conversation between Phaedo and Echecrates, and a conversation that asks after the aletheia of what happened there that day, is bound up with this revealing, the nature of the ability of words to reveal the nature of things, the nature of what happened. And I think there's something very powerful about that structure in relation to this final act
right.
of Socrates.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the take is somewhat Heideggerian,
sure.
right? This idea that in the uncovering, something gets to be covered, and what is being covered gets to be uncovered.
Right.
So this dialect between concealment and unconcealment.
And the uncovering itself allows for words to be spoken again, right?
Right.
So your point about it sort of being a quiet time, a moment of peacefulness or something, and solemnity.
Right.
As those gather there are watching Socrates, and boom, all of a sudden, here he is talking again.
Right. And it's this moment that I was saying in the paper, it's also a moment that prolongs time, right? I mean,
right.
I was very fond of this idea of this prolongation of time, this extra time that gets to be achieved in that gesture and in Socrates' overall philosophical activity, where what we gain is more time to, or more time which is free from the constraints normally placed on us by, business life, by occupation, by this kind of activities which have a goal set beyond themselves.
Right.
So, and then you lose sense, you lose pleasure for the present. Whereas one of the other things that I think has to be revealed in this act of uncovering is how Socrates is tied to the present, right, to the present of his life, to the present of his very being, which is, as a mortal being, as we said, since death is always physical, is a being which is rooted in physicality, exactly, right? So there are a lot of moments or a lot of aspects that, in fact, get to be uncovered in this uncovering. Right. And definitely, also, we were talking about it before, but Socrates' attention to his conversants, to the people, right, who are constantly, you know, getting conversations with him, and they come with, from very specific historical, physical, intellectual backgrounds, and Socrates does take those into account.
Well, and I think then I wanted to actually ask you a little bit more about that. So you and maybe we could talk also about the reading of the cock of Asclepius and the whole rooster theme, because there you did a really interesting thing. I want to hear more about that story. But I wanted to focus for a second on the very last phrase of,
yes,
Socrates's, right? And you've been translating that rightly. I mean, you make a good point in the paper that there's, 25 or however many different interpretations,
yeah,
and probably
100.
Exactly. But one of the interpretations that I find kind of compelling is that this last formulation, which Socrates says, you've been training and don't, how are you saying?
Well, the translation I had is, Crito, we owe a cock to Asclepius, so it's a collective we,
right,
of
exactly,
which Socrates makes himself part. And then it goes on, pay it, so it's a you, it's
right,
a collective
exactly,
you in the Greek, right?
Right.
You pay for it and do not neglect it. Now,
right,
it's not neglected,
right,
it's a tricky word.
That's what I was going to, so it's amalesete, so,
yes,
and do not be careless, and do not be careless, really,
and do
could
not,
be a way,
yes,
could
it
be
could
done,
be read that way, because melo,
yeah,
is to take care,
exactly,
of, right, meletus,
right,
so there
in
is
the,
also
in the apology,
connection,
so that's
apology,
where I wanted to press a little bit. So I mean there's an interpretation by a person named I think Leslie Madison is her name, and she has a pretty compelling argument. I think I have even the she has an essay called "Have We Been Careless with Socrates' Last Words?"
Right,
and she makes I think a pretty compelling case that that's really an injunction not only to be don't be careless about the paying,
yes,
of the debt, but don't be careless with your soul, right?
Yes.
Don't you here gathered? Don't be careless. And so it's not just related to the paying of the,
right,
debt, but it's an injunction. The final thing he says is, you know, in this double negative, right? Don't be careless.
That's
letotes,
right,
in Greek, right?
Right?
It's a very strange kind of formulation, but an important one, I think. And so, but I think, I mean, you're embracing that.
Yeah,
that,
yeah, and I am not sure. I mean, I have looked, you know, in different dictionaries and so about what's the root and what's the usage, and I wasn't able to track down that sense,
right,
which doesn't mean that it doesn't exist,
sure,
of course. And but I like that root because the very composition of the verb, amelesete, comes from taking care.
Right.
So the question is, well, what is it that we should not take care of?
Right?
Right. And so I would go along with that interpretation that clearly connects the verb to a sense of taking care of,
mm-hmm,
something, caring for something. I'm not sure whether that of which for which that which we should be taking care of is our soul, because then you get into, you know, difficult issues. What,
right,
is the soul?
Right.
And psyche, I'm not convinced that it's purely an immaterial or spiritual,
good,
principle,
yeah,
the way we understand,
right,
it. Right? So if you say,
well, linked to breath and,
right,
all of the things,
exactly,
that the Greeks already,
exactly,
right.
So
and bound up with the body. I mean, you know, I think there's a sense in which, so would you be amenable to the idea that, okay, in the same way that philosophy is characterized as the care of the soul and the care and the care of dying, too,
mm-hmm,
right there,
mm-hmm,
that word there appears again when Socrates,
yeah,
says early in the dialogue,
right,
there, philosophy is the care of dying. It's not for the sake of an afterlife, right?
Right.
It's on your reading, and I agree with this, it's really and counteracting Nietzsche and a whole tradition of Platonism, which says that Socrates and Plato were about fleeing the body as a prison and all of this. But it's really about a certain kind of life, which you really draw out.
A certain kind of life, yes. So I would say that it would refer to a certain lifestyle, which is this lifestyle of balance between the body and the soul, if we want to use the term. And it's the kind of life that Socrates has embodied, right, and represented in his very life. So it's almost an invitation not to forget to live a kind of life like the one Socrates led. So it's Socrates presenting himself as a role model, if we want. But then we have to go and take a close look at, well, what kind of role model in terms of lifestyle does he propose.
And I mean, that interpretation works so nicely with your overall interpretation, which, tell me if I'm characterizing it properly, by holding open this moment at the very end and by thematizing the space that opens when Socrates uncovers his head and speaks these words, we really have a kind of microcosm of the Phaedo as a whole, because that too is kind of a moment before death, a staving off of death for just a few hours, and so the temporality of the dialogue itself, and of course that could expand to the course of Socrates' life as a whole, too.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, the very structure and the very conclusion, Socrates lives in the present. He's there completely focused and concentrating on what's going on at the moment. And yet, through these very last words, he opens up the space for further conversation, or even just for further interpretation. And even, you know, the conversation does not, we don't get the recording of the conversation, we get a report of the conversation.
Exactly.
So there has already been an extension of time, a prolongation of time. And it's this idea that I find very fascinating of, you know, focusing on the present, but not in the sense in which, for example, we are so taken by the present because of our technology, where everything has to be immediate and exhausted in the immediacy, is a concentration on the present that prolongs the present, so it creates extra time. Right. So it is also an ecstatic present, not in a Heideggerian sense, but partly it's the idea that the present is both final and yet never completely final. There is always more time.
Right.
But you have to gain and create that time for yourself.
So let me push you a little bit on that. Because one of the things that struck me, and one of the things I try to make a kind of a big deal about in my reading of the Phaedo, is that the last words of Socrates are not the last words of the dialogue, right? Because there's a paragraph or so later where Phaedo then returns to talking about to Echecrates, and he says, actually, I think I have it, this was at the very end, this was the end of our friend, a man, as we might say, who was among those of that time we experienced, the best and wholly the most thoughtful and most just. And that last word is dikaiototou, right?
Yeah.
So this is the most just. And I think so. And that opens up the difference between the writing of Plato and the way that Plato has crafted this dialogue.
Yes.
And the saying of Socrates and the last words of Socrates.
Yes.
And so I wonder how that fits. I think it does fit into your account of Skole and of time. But I'm wondering, because one of the things you make a big point of is that this notion of skole is not instrumental.
Right.
And yet the activity of writing that Plato undertook has a dimension of instrumentality that I think is perhaps perhaps by writing in the way that he did, he was actually able to undermine the instrumentality dimension of it. But of course, we wouldn't be talking about this at all if we didn't have the writing.
Right, right. But it's an instrumentality. I mean, Plato obviously writes the dialogues in order for us to read the dialogue. So there is a goal beyond the pure writing of the dialogue. But again, is a writing which is not inserted in any mechanism of production or, you know, activity which is finalized at a certain specific goal, which can be economic or not. But, you know, in a way, the very writing of the dialogue is geared toward creating more dialogues.
Right.
So it's a self-fulfilling almost, it's an activity that finds its goal within itself. We don't go outside the scheme of prolonging time for the sake of time. And in the very same last words, right, the ones you read, well, Socrates has created some extra time. Plato has inserted that extra time in the dialogue, and the dialogue themselves become this extra time, this space where extra time is allowed to be generated, and we talk about them. But even our talking about the dialogue, we can talk about the dialogue with the purpose of studying it for an exam,
right.
Then that extra time, you know, gets to be finalized, and that probably is not the sense, the reason why the dialogue was written. Or we can simply talk about the dialogue because we get to reflect about these issues.
Right.
So that is what the moment of Scholae to me represents, is these activities that they have some purposes, of course. I enjoy talking with you about philosophy, right? Philosophy becomes a situation or an occasion for people to bodily gather physically together and have a good time. And I mean, the symposium is a great example, right? It is a great example of a philosophical conversation where the needs of the body are being taken care of. They have some wine, not too much, because of we know all the story there. So there is this sense of creating something, but that something is an activity, but it's not finalized to an external goal.
I mean, this really resonates with one of the main things that I want to press upon with regard to what these texts of Plato are doing with us as readers, because they are, I mean, you're okay with everything material like this, there is a dimension of perhaps instrumentality. I mean, as you say, students can be reading these texts for the sake of an exam and a grade and whatever else, a degree, right? We can be writing articles and even producing podcasts on this, these things, because of some professional goals or a sense of instrumental needs that we have in our own lives. And that shouldn't be denied. But I think what you're pointing to, and I think I would endorse, is what the dialogues themselves then open up for us who are willing to enter into them as collaborative readers with one another and with the text, is this opportunity to reflect upon what is this figure who was the most just?
Right.
What is the nature of Socrates and the life that he lived? And what is the nature of the ideals toward which he encouraged those he was speaking with to think about, the ideals of justice, beauty, and the good?
And I think that, you know, you were talking about the materiality of the text, and the choice of writing a dialogue as opposed to writing a treatise, right? That is a material choice that is being made. And
and it's also maybe an affirmation of the bottle, of the material, of materiality.
Yes.
That Socrates himself didn't. Oh, well, of course, at the beginning of the Phaedo, he is writing.
He's writing. Yeah, that's true too. I hadn't thought too much about that, but it's true. I mean, maybe writing is a way of honoring Socrates, exactly in this more material, bodily aspect. Because as we know, the words stay, right? I mean, the words fly. Written words stay.
And when you link it to the Phaedrus and the worry about the dead word and the word and words calcifying and becoming bandied about by anyone who doesn't know what to do with them, that concern, which was voiced by Socrates, was probably present in Plato's mind, at least in order to write that into that dialogue, didn't preclude him from writing. And in fact, I think he has written texts in such a way that we're really not permitted to become passive receivers of the text.
We have to do this. Yeah, and we become the conversant with the text, right? So this modality of the dialogue, and I mean, we are not simply debating what's the meaning of Socrates' message, because in a way there is no message. We are creating the message, right? And so we enter in this conversation, this extra time that we are really making in a conversation with the dialogue. And so in many senses, the dialogue, I think, as a textual choice, as a specific, as a choice of a specific way of writing, is this creation of extra time, is this activity that has a goal. We read it, we converse about it, but the goal is the generation of more of itself.
But I mean, I think I agree completely with that, and I think even if we push it a little bit further, there's a kind of normativity that emerges out of it. What are the virtues of reading that we're invited to engage in when we read a Platonic text? It precludes the adoption or appropriation of the text for instrumental means, right? It in fact requires, I would say, things like a certain kind of hermeneutical imagination, a certain willingness and openness to the colleagues with whom one reads. Mm-hmm. So whether they be students that you're introducing Plato to for the first time, or colleagues in the Ancient Philosophy Society who are really well versed with the text, and the dynamic of that dialogue has to be one of shared seeking rather than, you know, as so many philosophical conversations often turn into, one-upsmanship and sort of trying to win arguments and these kinds of things.
Right. And also, I mean, there is the this hermeneutic imaginativeness or how
imagination,
but it's also the ability to be imaginative.
Imaginative,
right?
Exactly.
So, but there is also the need for a careful reading and a very, very attentive reading of whether the details, you know, the words, the grammatical structure, the characters. And that is an attention to the body of the text.
Right.
So again, it's an activity. I want to push this because this is what is of interest to me in Socrates' figure. The dimension of materiality, the body, etc., are celebrated in these forms of writing or in this kind of lifestyle which is inspired by Scholae, which is, ruled by Scholae.
Right. A great example of your own creative imagination and attention to details of the text was in this discussion of the rooster, as you were trying to uncover and criticize the translation of Scholae as leisure as come down to. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that, because I really want to, I love that. It was great.
Yeah.
And you put the right, you know, qualifications. This is getting a little crazy here, but I mean, I thought it was really wonderful.
Well, it's an act of creative imagination.
Sure. Yeah.
I don't know that it is completely arbitrary because, it is grounded on some text, except that it is a text of some written later than Socrates, which doesn't mean that the story was not circulated. But there is, it was interesting to me that Socrates says, let's sacrifice a rooster. Because the rooster was one of the animals dear to Asclepius, but even today we associate Asclepius with the snake of medicine,
uh-huh.
Right? So it was one of the animals, but perhaps not the privileged animal, the privileged association that was made with Asclepius. And so I started wondering, well, why a rooster? Can the rooster say anything? I mean, it seems strange that such a good writer as Plato or Socrates would mention a rooster.
And imagine if it had been a snake. That would be a whole different
exactly.
thing to think about, too.
Probably would have opened up a different realm of interpretative possibilities. So I did a little bit of research, and I found out that the term for rooster is alectruon. And alectruon, in fact, in mythology, was this young guy who used to be a man or a young boy, and he was associating with Ares, the god of war, the god of violence, the god of immoderation, really. Alectruon used to associate himself with Ares, and they would have parties together and so on. And then Ares had put Alectruon basically to watch while he himself was having an affair with Aphrodite,
yeah.
who was the wife of Hephaestus,
right.
And but Helios, the sun god, Scott saw that, in fact, Ares was having this affair, and so he rushed to Hephaestus to tell him, well, look, your wife is being unfaithful to you. And so Ares got very upset at all of this. He got caught in the act, basically, and he turned Alectruon, the boy, into a rooster. And so I played a little bit of a game on this, and I started thinking that, in fact, what is being... I mean, here you have a young boy turn into an animal body, and that what Socrates is doing by sacrifice, invoking the sacrifice, is invoking a sacrifice of the animal body, because obviously he wouldn't be invoking the sacrifice of... I mean, human sacrifice was... Well, in the past, at the time when Socrates was writing, Plato was writing and Socrates was having this conversation with his friends. And so it played very nicely into this idea that what's going on there is Socrates is asking for a sacrifice of the most animalistic aspects of bodily life. And it's exactly getting rid of the most animalistic aspects of bodily life that enables us to recover the body as a human body. Mm-hmm. But the body as a human body does not exist really in separation from a more intellectual, spiritual dimension, which we could call psuche or mm-hmm. the soul mm-hmm. or something like that. So it is a certain kind of body, a certain kind of emphasis of a certain way of bodily lifestyle that gets to be retrieved. So we are supposed to sacrifice our animalistic instincts, if you want, but not necessarily our earthly material makeup.
I mean, I think, first of all, the use of that myth was really great.
It
fit in really nicely, and of course, the notion of the rising of the sun and the temporality of that is built into it. But let me press you a little bit then on the notion of the animalistic mm-hmm. body, because I worry a little bit that by making that move, you repeat the same kind of move that it has historically been associated with Platonism, namely the rejection of the body. Okay, now you've made a distinction between the human body and the animal body in order to say, well, it was just the animal body which we want to distance ourselves from and sacrifice from. And I worry that that means that, well, there's a kind of denial of the animalistic nature of human being as well.
Well, I think that the issue is that... the body may, in fact, be the link between humans and animals. But the body itself is more complex than we may want to assume, in the sense that... And the reason is that the human being is not simply... And I hate this language because it's very Cartesian and very dualistic, but forgive me for using it. The human being, let's say, is this mixture of body and soul. Right, and it's exactly our ability. Well, the animal has no control over its body, and that's what constitutes, I would say, the animalistic mm-hmm. aspect. Right, the animal is completely, in a way, dominated, and or not even dominated. It's not a matter of domination. The animal is its mm-hmm. instincts, its mm-hmm. bodies. Right, and we may be friends of animals, but you know, when the dog is hungry, the dog is hungry. When you can train the dog, but you have to do it in certain ways that still act on some sort of an animalistic base. The human being, because the human being is not purely animalistic body, but it's also a more intellectual component, has the ability to enter a certain relation with his or her own body, which is a relation of I don't want to say control, but it's certainly an education of the body, right? So that what you attain, which the animal cannot attain, is a harmony between various components. So whereas the animal is just one thing, if you want to put it like that, and is sort of subjected to that one thing that it is, its animalistic makeup, and There is something good to that. I mean, I don't think that we should, think the animals inferior because we don't have a mind. They're simply different. But we want to make account, to be able to account for differences. The difference of the human existence is that we have those two components and they interact and they have the ability to play themselves out in different ways. So Socrates is somebody who has reached a balance, and that is what health is, right? Mm-hmm. It's the balance between different components, so that one of either of them cannot take over and become the dominating one, which would cause an imbalance. And that holds true both for the more bodily physical component or the more intellectual component. And that is what Asclepius, as a doctor, teaches has to do to achieve a balance in terms of health,
right.
Bodily health. And bodily health has to also include the more spiritual side.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I wonder if, I mean, because I, let me press that a little bit further, because I think you're exactly right that differences have to be established between, let's say, animal embodiment mm-hmm. and human embodiment. I also worry that that distinction, when pressed, it really is difficult to draw the line. So if I'm thinking, for example, of, in Aristotle and the Dianema and elsewhere in Aristotle too, that distinction between, the animalistic soul and the human soul,
yes.
and that which is a very embodied thing for Aristotle, is there's certain modes of perceiving that animals have that humans mm-hmm. also have, but even with regard to the notion of the imagination, animals seem to have perceptive imagination, but not deliberative imagination.
Yeah.
So there are differences to be made, and I wonder if one of the differences is, I mean, even if we grant a certain kind of intellectual capacity to certain kinds of animals,
mm-hmm.
This ability to see one's life as a whole, to organize one's life according to ideals to which Socrates always draws
yeah.
our attention
yeah.
is part of that. And it does link into your points about skole, about time and about the course of a life. I mean, I see Socrates as constantly drawing the attention of his interlocutors to, well, okay, what kind of life are you leading here?
Mm-hmm.
You
mm-hmm.
know,
mm-hmm.
And it may be that component, the ability to see our, I was going to say step out, but it's really not a step out, right?
Step out,
you have
yeah.
to see within life the course
right.
of a life.
Right. Yeah, because I would almost say the animal, it's immediacy.
Yeah.
Right? The human
they respond,
being,
they see, they respond.
Yeah.
Right?
And they are completely taken in the present, in a
mm-hmm.
sense. At least as far as we can tell.
Sure.
Right? But the animal lives in the present.
But of course, I mean, there's always going to be exceptions to that with certain kinds of
yes.
animals that seem to show some ability to plan or to at least to a minimal dimension
yeah,
of planning.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Sure.
And even, I mean, it's very reductivistic to say the animals.
Right.
Because there
exactly.
are so many different kinds of animals, right?
Right? And we ourselves are animals.
And we ourselves are our animals, in addition to. Unlike animals, we have the ability to distance ourselves and
right.
our immediacy.
So in the Heideggerian vocabulary, that's probably the difference between a Welt and an Umwelt, between
right.
a world and an environment. So
right.
humans have a world,
right.
animals have an environment to which they respond.
Right. But then the human being too has, I would almost say, an obligation. And
yeah.
if I read Socrates along my lines of interpretation, it's very clear that this is... not only an obligation, but is the model that we should follow, according to Socrates at least. We have an obligation to live in a certain belt, right? I mean,
right.
and Heidegger is very clear about his definition of Dasein. One of the first characters of Dasein is being in the world.
Exactly.
And yet not being completely absorbed by the world. But you have to go back to that world, and that is the trait that we share with animals. But we go back in a different way than animals do. Now, I think that if we want to, push this farther in a different direction than Socrates or in general terms of Socrates' interest in the sense of animal ethics or this kind of considerations of what's the place of animals in philosophy and in life and so on. I want to both maintain the difference between animals and humans, because I think that if we deny the difference, that's unifying and that totalizing.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to maintain the difference. On the other hand, I don't want the difference to deny the elements of similarity which are present there.
Right. Or to legitimate, the danger is that we allow the differences to legitimize certain unethical ways of treating
the
animal kingdom.
Becomes a hierarchy.
Exactly.
And then we talk about the superiority of the animal, of the human being to the animal, and that kind of, you know, rhetorical moves, I think, were very self-serving in the end, and self-interested, and that's not what it is about.
I think the one thing that really came out of the paper, one of the really rich things, was this recognition that what Socrates is performing in this dialogue in the Phaedo is a certain way of being in the world.
Yes.
And that is associated with, I think, a certain way of being towards one's own finitude, right? So he's there with his friends. They are distraught. They're trying to prove the immortality of the soul. The logos is completely failing them.
Right.
He warns in the middle, you know, the worst danger would be that you'd become haters of logos, you'd become misologues. Don't let that happen.
Right.
And, of course, the dialogue itself shows that didn't happen, because Phaedo and Echecrates are not haters of logos. They're in fact still using logos,
and not only they're still using logos, but they are narrating, right? And the dialogue is a dialogue in logos.
Exactly.
And so they are carrying on
exactly
the activity of being logic.
So and so there, I mean, and there I think we could, if we link that to Aristotle's famous discussion of human beings being the animal with logos, doesn't necessarily mean that other animals don't have logos, if we think of a broader understanding of logos in a Heraclitean sense of the sort of the ordering and the unfolding of the world.
Right.
But it's that we have a certain way of having logos, that we are able to use logos and not only use, because it's not instrumental, right? It is, we're able to engage with logos in a way that opens up new possibilities of relations with one another that can be enriching. Because you did gesture at the in the paper at the end to the political notion of skole, and maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, it's an act of resistance, right? It's an act of resistance against this sort of very economic world, or world driven by economic concerns in which we live, where, and the economic concerns can be financial concerns of just, even where everything has to be finalized to a goal aside itself. And probably the question that for our times is what for? It seems like whatever activity we initiate has to be for some purpose. You cannot just take a walk in the woods because you enjoy it. It has to be to make you feel fit or make you feel good.
You
about
can't get an education without saying, well, what's this worth in terms of the job you're going to get and all this.
Exactly. And so this focusing on the notion of skole and retrieving Socrates as a figure of skole, it's an act of resistance toward the current political social system. And in that sense, too, Socrates is a revolutionary, and that might also be part of, you know, the reasons, the political reasons that led to his condemnation. After all, here you have somebody who is a parasite to society, and he wants to be, and he advocates for becoming even more of a parasite, right? He wants free meals in the Prytaneum.
Right, so, at the heart of the city, right?
Yeah, he's embracing it, right?
Exactly.
And so he defies this productivistic model where if you don't produce, you're not worth anything, you have no value. And he is reclaiming the fact that no, the value of activities is in the activities themselves. And actually by focusing on this value of the activities in themselves, you perform a very deeply political act, subversion, but in an economy, or in a world, I use economy now in the sense of in a world, the political world where this were to be allowed, it would be interesting to see what kind of society we would have.
And I would say that you are... first of all, I think the fact that you're thematizing this in political terms is really powerful from my perspective, because one of the things that I try to do is thematize the practices of Socratic dialogue as essentially political, primarily both in the terms of the resistance to a certain way of doing things, but also in terms of the ability to create community around the logoi that he's articulating with the person and get us to think about those ideals toward which we might orient our lives, even though they remain forever elusive, right? The ideals of justice and beauty and the good. But one of the things that is particularly important about what you're saying is that the activity of reading Plato then becomes a political activity, a collaborative political activity that we, because we're opening up a space for one another and for our students in the classroom to consider the course of their lives, to consider these larger issues, the diversity of issues raised by these texts.
Right. And also, and here, I mean, I'm not sure what kind of terrain we're going to get into, but we also think about education as nurturing, for the most part, especially in the academia and college, and so, nurturing the mind. But if we pay attention to Socrates and this attention to the bodily aspects and how body and mind go together in this kind of balance, you cannot hold a good class, a good lecture, or a good, you know, have a good educational experience in a classroom which has certain physical limitations. Mm-hmm. For example, where the body is not comfortable, where the lights are not inducive to staying awake, or you have no windows, or, you know. So really an attention to the physical realm within which we carry out this activity of scholae. So it's not simply... for the mind, it's for the pleasure that goes together for the mind and the body, and you need to create those elements which are pleasurable, if you want. I mean, the fact that good, beauty, and justice go together, for me, for the Greeks, is fundamental. You cannot have goodness where there is no beauty. So that would probably bring us to revisit some of our architectural ways of building. And I mean, Heidegger makes the same point in Building, Dwelling, Thinking under a different, you know, from a different perspective. But the environment within which we live, within which we teach, within which we do our business has a part.
Yeah, and I mean, I think one of the things that's been increasingly interesting to me is the whole the dimension of design, learning design, and in terms of spaces, the design of space to enable active learning, right? So that the chairs aren't locked down in specific spots, and that you can actually move them, and that then the lighting is conducive to discussion, even the colors on the walls. It also opens up a whole range of issues associated with distance education, with online learning, which, which on the one hand you could say, well, that's it just should be rejected because of this. But there's a certain embodiment associated with the digital dimensions, and there's a certain way in which design can function even in those contexts to facilitate active learning.
Right. Although what you lose there, of course, is the physicality of the bodily presence, right? Because then the body is there only as a virtual body. And then it creates a different set of issues and problems. Whereas, given the technological tools that we had available, obviously there was not this kind of technology, but so much part of Socrates is the face-to-face.
I keep coming back to the idea that for the new technology at that time was writing, and that's where right? That's where Socrates said, no, I'm not going to do that, right? Yes. And Plato said, yes, he was going to do it. And so, and there are, it's a pharmacon. There are affordances and real dangers,
yes.
right?
Yes.
And there,
yes.
it's a medicine and a poison at once. There are things gained and things lost.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons why, you know, I've been really enjoying doing things like podcasting, because on the one hand, there is this dimension of the digital. It's mediated by the digital, but also it's often, I mean, I've done it at distances too, but it's great to have these face-to-face conversations.
Right.
There's something about the spoken word that is more dynamic than the written word and less easily quotable and taken out of context.
Right.
And so it you know, all of these aspects really have to be attended to. And I think one of the things that you bring up so nicely about the notion of embodiment and philosophical embodiment is that we don't just adopt these things thoughtlessly. We think about what their affordances are and what their limitations are.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, it's been really wonderful having you here on the Digital Dialogue.
Thank you. It was a pleasure for me too. Thanks.
So this has been the Digital Dialogue. The Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons Share and Share Alike license. I invite you to visit us on our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/digitaldialogue and on the blog at www.la.psu.edu/chrislong. This has been the Digital Dialogue.